She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are listening to Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And remember, we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. I promise you, you will have lots to think about today. Thank you for joining us. Things are a little bit out of order because I would like to first introduce our guest, who is going to be talking to us about what I think probably is the most important subject that we can talk about globally today, and it's water. It is the one thing we can't live without. Ed Osan, who is a senior policy analyst for the National Resources Defense Council, is our guest. There have been some recent new water efficiency movements in California, and he knows a lot about water and a bunch of other things. Ed, welcome, and thanks for being our guest today.
Hi. She's glad to be here.
I know. I put up on Facebook, I promised you a return trip because our conversation got kind of shortened last time, and that always annoys me because I want to ask more questions. So thanks for saying yes for coming back. And I just have a couple of brief announcements, and then we'll get right to you, Ed. The show is brought to you in part by Goodwill Industries of Southern Arizona, where their business is changing lives. And if you're ever a part of Mrs. Green's World, you know that's something I believe. It's not just about their resale stores. It's about what they do with the money they raise and change lives. Indeed, they do. So we're proud to have them as a sponsor. And then, as you probably know, that for the very first time that we have been on the air, we did not broadcast a show last Saturday. We were dark because we had our serve room is in New York, and we got no signal. So we were down for about 7 days. And that being said, we continue to send our thoughts and prayers to the millions of people whose lives continue to be impacted by Superstorm Sandy. I'm a Jersey girl. And I can tell you from the friends I have been talking to almost daily that the devastation is still hard for me to get my head around. It's very complicated. You know, some obvious things, the density, the population, the 6 million people that go in and out of New York City every day to work, and the trees. Just my friend said to me, she can't drive two blocks in Jersey without finding a tree in the road. So many of the major ways that people commute, whether it be on bus or train, on the parkways or the turnpikes, they're not being able to get into New York, and they're still very, very crippled. So if you're in a position to support the relief effort in any way, to me there's no amount that is too small. Find the best way for you. There are efforts being led all over the country. If you Google it, you can go down the Google rabbit hole. And don't forget, if animals are what touches your heart, there's a lot of need for dog food and cat food and food for the horses. So it's not just about the two-legged, it's about the four-legged. And I just encourage you to try to do something. And, you know, this show will live on a podcast, and I dare say even when it's broadcast 6 months from now, there are still going to be people who need help because the cleanup is going to be vast and extremely challenging. Okay, that's one announcement, and I added a little bit more because it's such a heart thing for me. Please remember to join me live every Saturday at noon. Now it's Arizona time. We're the only state in the country, I believe, that doesn't change time. So it's 11 Pacific and 2 Eastern at MrsGreensWorld.com, and you can listen on your iPhone or Droid. If you don't get to hear the show, you can listen on my podcast. They live on the website forever. We retweet them, we post them, because mostly people are turning to the podcast to either listen to the show again, or to listen to it whenever the heck they want. Okay, one more, Ed. Just stay with me, and then we're all about you. A quick shout-out from one of our wonderful sponsors. This is a sponsor-supported mission-based company that helps support the mission of my world is EcoBella. And EcoBella was started to provide cruelty-free organic and natural skincare products. They happen to be located in New Jersey. Their efforts have grown to 4,800 retail outlets. They have everything from organics to vitamins. And we're happy that they joined us in this mission because they really are sustainable. They are really committed to being corporate stewards of our environment and our health. And I wanted to add a short personal observation because I am using their products. They wanted me to be able to comfortably personally endorse them. And this is the one thing I noticed that I have not mentioned on the show. There's an old commercial that Ed, you might know, and I think Mr. Green might know, but remember A Little Dabble, Do Ya?
So that's going back to black and white TV.
Going back to black and white TV, and it was Brill Cream. I could do the whole ditty. But with Eco Bella, with two C's, I might add, their products are so pure and so highly concentrated that I've been using them for almost 6 months, and the bottle has hardly gone down, each one of the skincare products I use, because a little goes a long way. So I heartily endorse them. Please check them out yourself and let me know what you think. If you, on any level, I'd love to hear from you. If you visit myecobella.com, you do receive a special Mrs. Green discount, and there is certainly no downside to that. So this company, as I said, headquartered in New Jersey, check them out. They're the kind of businesses we want to support. Okay, there's my intro. Now it's all about Ed Osan, who is, as I said, a senior policy analyst from the National Resources Defense Council. And Ed, if it's okay with you, from now on, I'm going to say NRDC, because
Correct.
That's really a mouthful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have a very extensive repertoire of things that you could talk about in your role at NRDC. The notes that you sent, were to talk about water, which is one of my favorite topics. I've had Robert Glennon on the show. I've had quite a few water experts that are focusing on the dry desert Southwest. So I'd love to hear, first of all, your reason for your emphasis on water and studying it, and why the NRDC is picking this as one of its policy areas to be very actively involved in.
Sure. Actually, I'd like to start by associating myself with the points that you made about the storm in the Northeast and the need for attention to the people and the systems that have been impacted by that. We had our own servers go down, and our own New York office was blacked out and closed for about a week. And it's incredibly disruptive in this day and age to lose power, especially lose power for an extended period of time. And that's just part of it. The storm surge and the flooding that took place, the impacts there, people are going to be dealing with for many months, if not years. And it seems as though, just to offer an observation here, it seems as though the significance, the breadth, the severity of this storm has rekindled some thought about not only our preparedness in general, but how we as a country ought to be thinking about coping with these kinds of disasters in the future, which may become more frequent and may become more severe as a result of climate change, and the implications of climate change for a lot of our existing infrastructure and our economy. I think we're kind of driven home by these unfortunate events of the last few weeks.
I mean, I totally agree with you. And I guess my question is, you said, we can assume they're going to continue. From where I sit, and as the non-senior policy analyst, don't you think we can really expect more severe weather, because the pattern has been very consistent of just, aberrant conditions, to say the least, but where we're going is getting people's attention. The non-believers and the people on the fence are saying, we better pay attention to this. The governor of New Jersey.
Yeah. Well, there's considerable uncertainty in associating any particular weather event with longer term climate change. And there's also uncertainty in the modeling of the the specific impacts of climate change on specific pieces of geography, a state or a basin or something.
Right,
there,
right.
There, of course, there is modeling on that, but there's the results come out with a band of potential impacts. But one of the, if climate change means anything, one of the most predictable impacts is the rise of the sea level, and that will have an effect on coastal communities all over the globe.
Totally.
Some that are more subject to tidal movements than others, it'll be more potentially more severe. But you know, the ocean level, you know, worldwide is going to be rising, and that alone has implications not only for the built infrastructure but also for our water supplies. We have greater potential for saltwater intrusion into freshwater coastal aquifers, just as one particular byproduct of that phenomenon, and there are many others. If climate change means anything at all, it's going to mean that warming temperatures increase the ET requirement, the water use requirements of our landscapes and our crops.
Right.
And I think this is a phenomenon that is not well appreciated by water utilities at this point, by water suppliers, by people whose responsibility it is to be thinking about matching supply and demand and maintaining reliability of service in future years. So we really ought to be thinking hard about how much irrigated landscape we bring on in new development in our communities, and whether those landscapes really need to be maintained with, you know, drinking water that we irrigate with, or whether there are ways of providing functional and attractive landscapes in the future that can be sustained with natural precipitation, native vegetation, or reuse supplies of water rather than drinking water.
Now,
these are some of the things that I think we ought to be thinking about and thinking about sooner rather than later.
In that statement, in that picture that you paint for us, is inherent in that if you live in Hood River, Oregon, it's certainly okay for you to have a different landscape than if you live in Tucson, Arizona, or Phoenix, or some drier parts of California. Is that erroneous thinking?
No, I don't think that's erroneous at all. It's a big country, and there's a lot of diversity in it. I mean, just to state the obvious, we do a lot of work in the Great Lakes region, for instance, and we do a lot of work on water conservation, water efficiency in the Great Lakes region. Now, that's a water-rich part of the country in a general sense.
Right.
So our water efficiency work is not trying to promote, you know, cactus yards in
right.
Cleveland. You know, so there are the whole country is divided up into climate zones, and we've got different precipitation patterns, and these are subject to shifting over time as a result of the impacts of climate change. But our approach to this is to encourage efficiency that is regionally appropriate. And in the more water-rich parts of the country, you have the opportunity to take advantage of more abundant natural precipitation.
Right.
So, you know, you have a different plant palette in the Midwest than you have in the Southwest.
But it's interesting to me also in that response that I picked Hood River because I spent 8 days there this summer, and one of their absolute hottest topics and the most highly regulated utility is water. I mean, the water rights in that whole region, because it's such a farming region for fruit trees and so on, and increasingly wine, the water rights are hotly debated. They are highly regulated because there they seem to have a proactive appreciation for this is not infinite supply. You know, I didn't associate if you have fallow land and you have 10 acres and you're next to another farm, That's not allowed in that whole river valley. It's not allowed because it can be put everybody else, make them susceptible to disease, because you have to keep your land healthy so that the next person's land doesn't get unhealthy if you decide not to farm. So even there, there's a consciousness about water that seems to me be very, very aggressive in a good way and very conscious of what if they have a drought. I mean, they take their water very seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, you know, I think we should all take our water seriously.
I agree.
And we can start wherever we are, whether we're in Arizona or California or Ohio or New York, you know, one, start with the basics. Start to think about this. You know, don't get astounded by, you know, the global, all the global relationships in the water cycle. Just start with the basics. Where does your water come from? The water that comes out of your tap, for most Americans, doesn't come from, you know, directly under their house.
Right, anywhere near here.
You know, 10 or 15% in round numbers, people have their own well. But most people's residences are served by a public water supplier. So where does that water actually come from? Where does the water from the piped distribution system that's piped right to your house, where does it originate? And I think it's healthy for people to know and understand where their water actually comes from. Their electricity is a little bit more hard to pin down because electrons are kind of fungible and they're going back and forth with alternating current. So you have this big live circuit that is fed by various power plants all over the place.
Right.
The water comes from someplace to your house. So you can ask your utility. And in fact, your utility is obligated to tell you. In a communication once a year, you have made available to you a drinking water report under the Safe Drinking Water Act.
Right.
Public water suppliers have to provide an annual report every year. And one of the first lines in that report is what's the source of the water. Now, occasionally they'll get by if they buy wholesale from another water supplier, they'll say, oh, well, our water comes from the XYZ water agency or water company. That's really not good enough. You need to know where that water comes from, because it does come from a particular place. So does it come from groundwater? And if so, then that invites some thinking and some inquiry about are those groundwater supplies susceptible to contamination, or is the area effectively managed to prevent contamination? Are the groundwater supplies being managed sustainably, or is the pumping, you know, driving down the water table, you know, year after year after year, so it costs more and more, and there's more and more energy going into pumping it out from deeper and deeper levels, and that can raise questions about the quality of the water if you're moving into different strata and different age, you know, rocks that it's coming from, maybe different constituents in that groundwater. So there are questions there that I think an informed citizen, informed householder would be useful to know and to share with your children and with your neighbors. Does it come from a river? And if so, you know, what river or creek does it come from? What's the nature of that watershed? You know, much of Arizona and a lot of California is very dependent upon the Colorado River.
Totally.
Well, the Colorado River is over allocated. They divided up more water than the river reliably produces when they carved it up by with an interstate compact in the 1920s.
And we are on the bottom. We're on the bottom of the food chain here.
Yeah, yeah. And that was even before the impacts of climate change became apparent. It was apparent 20 years ago that the river had been over allocated. So there is a significant issue and problem with the Colorado, but that's not the only watershed in the country that faces stress. In the southeast, the river system and watershed that serves Metro Atlanta, which ultimately flows into the Gulf of Mexico at Apalachicola Bay in Florida, is hotly contested among the three states. Is a supply that is under stress, and you have resources like Apalachicola Bay that is really a world-class seafood producer, and the balance of maintaining fresh water into an estuary is so important to maintaining the viability and health of the marine life in those coastal bays. You have coastal bays in Texas that are in jeopardy because of reduced freshwater inflow. And of course, one of the classic tragedies is the Colorado River Delta itself, which is in Mexico, but not far over the border from the United States. And it's almost completely desiccated. There's very little, relatively speaking, very little wetland left from the original deltaic system of the Colorado, because so much has been taken upstream, both in the United States and in Mexico.
And I think you very effectively paint a picture of what I call the ripple effect, no pun intended for the water analogy. But so the food, the fish, you know, the seafood supply, which people really like good seafood, they want to eat their fish, and it's impacting the economic impact of the people that is their industry. So that suffers.
Yes.
And it's not
in
just
California,
like
California, we didn't just mention in California on that point. In California, we had the commercial salmon fishery was closed down for 3 years, and there are communities in Northern California where commercial fishing is a significant part of the local economy. Those fisheries were shut because of water problems in the Central Valley associated with short supplies and agricultural diversions and hydropower production and that sort of thing. And that was directly impacted communities that depend on the resource for their livelihood.
Okay, this is a perfect time to take a short break. We are speaking with Ed Osan about a most important topic. He's from the National Resources Defense Council. We're talking about water and how it affects all of us. Please stay here with me. We'll be right back and continue the conversation.
In the mid-Tucson summer, you would expect it to be over 100 degrees. But deep beneath the University of Arizona's compost heap, temperatures can hit 160. Started by the Compost Cats student group, the U of A Compost Project is collecting tons of waste from around campus and keeping it out of landfills. Gathering garbage and converting it into a useful product for the community? Now that's a hot idea indeed. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
She's the most exciting thing that's ever happened to you, and you want to spend eternity with her. She deserves nothing less than the best, an Abbott Taylor original. A diamond engagement ring as exceptional as she is that will make her eyes sparkle every time she sees it. Because we design and make our own jewelry, we can create something wonderful for every budget. I'm Abbott Taylor. I'd like to invite you to come see what Abbott Taylor Jewelers has waiting for you. With 35 years and thousands of original jewelry designs, no one has more experience in designing and making diamond jewelry in Tucson than Abbott Taylor Jewelers. We're proud to say, using recycled gold, we have saved over 100 million pounds of toxic waste from this planet. Abbott Taylor Jewelers at 6383 East Grant Road, on Facebook, and on the web at atdiamonds.com. Abbott Taylor Jewelers. Diamond designs for everyone. Abbott Taylor Jewelers.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green with some exciting news. The all-new 2013 Honda Accord is here. It's got a new level of sophistication. It's an efficiency expert, and when you drive one, you can discover how EcoAssist can help you increase your fuel efficiency. For a record 26th time, the Honda Accord has been named to Car and Driver's esteemed 10 Best list. To check them out, visit Chapman Honda at 4646 East 22nd Street. They have a great selection of 2013 Accords in stock right now.
You can always find things around the house to give to Goodwill, but I have a bigger reason to give. A while back, I lost my job and I couldn't even support my family. A lot of people don't know Goodwill can help you find a job, but that's what they did for me. I've had this job for 7 years and I love going to work. You know how they say Goodwill changes lives? Well, it's true. Goodwill needs your donations now more than ever. Please donate today.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And today we're asking you to think about I guess for me, it is. I'm interested in a lot of subjects, but I am absolutely obsessed with water use, the lack of water globally, 1.5 billion people not having access to clean water. So we are very, very fortunate to have interviewing today Ed Osan, who's a senior policy analyst for the National Resources Defense Council, talking to us about that very issue, water, water shortages, water efficiency. And Ed, unless there's a thought you want to carry over from a segue to me, is there's two parts of this that I wanted to talk to you about. Here in the Southwest, we don't really care about water generally. And one of the reasons is it is so darn cheap. I mean, it is so inexpensive here. My water bill, it's like $30. We don't have a pool. We got rid of our pool because I'm Mrs. Green. I mean, some people have lots higher water bills in the summer. But compared to my utility bill, it's a fraction. I care about water because I'm Mrs. Green, and the consciousness of the scarcity is huge. But in general, since you work nationally and globally, do people respect the fact that water is something we should really be paying attention to, and the conservation of it, and the efficiency of it, and the transportation of it? That's a long question, but I know you can handle it.
Right. Yeah. Well, the reality is we're all kind of amateur water managers, right? I mean, we have a day job, we have other things going on, and we rely on our utility to provide water when we turn on the tap. And we're not, in our day-to-day, you know, routine, we're not really challenged to think too much further than that. But that's what we're trying to do today. We're trying to think, you know, go further upstream and kind of consider the implications. So let's just start with the resources that you command as a homeowner, as a householder, whether you're in a home or apartment, how much water do you use? How much water is coming to your house in a typical month? And start by taking a look at your bill. Now, one of the little quirks in water utility service is that many utilities don't send people bills that are very clear. They don't send them bills that are very that are clearly indicative of how much water is actually being used. Quite often, for reasons of tradition and engineering that go back decades but are not particularly relevant today, most utilities bill in units that are called HCF, or hundreds of cubic feet. So who thinks about fluid volumes in cubic feet? You know, no,
not me.
Nobody,
like, really?
Nobody thinks about, yeah,
what is
going
that?
To, going to the store to buy, you know, buy a Coke or soda of some kind. You know, you're not thinking about what, you know, how many cubic inches that is.
No, you're not.
You're not. So that's kind of step one, to kind of get your mind around how much water you're really using. And surveys have shown that most people grossly underestimate how much water they're actually using. To 100 cubic feet, well, let's start with a cubic foot. A cubic foot is 7.48 gallons, and 100 cubic feet would be 748 gallons. So when you look at your bill, and if you see HCF, then you just make a little pencil note, that's 748 gallons. And other utilities will bill in units of 1,000 gallons. So you might have a notation that's 27 or 36 or 15, but those are thousands of gallons. So
means nothing to me.
Read
right?
your bill. Read your, well, think about a gallon
yeah.
of milk in the refrigerator.
Right.
And then think about 1,000 gallons stacked. Think of how big a pyramid 1,000 milk cartons, milk bottles,
right.
gallon containers
right.
would be, and then multiply that times the monthly, you know, the monthly indicator on your bill of the how many thousands of gallons you're using. People have a special concern and relationship with water, because water is essential for life. We get a lot of other utility services that are important, and when they're disrupted, we see how important they really have become to us. but water is essential to life. But the amount of water that really is essential for the core functions that we have for sanitation and for cooking is a tiny, tiny fraction of the total amount of water that gets used in most households in the United States. So having a getting a sense of proportion of what's involved with the amount of water that's coming to your coming into your home on a monthly basis, and then begin to think about how that water is used, because you know you're not drinking all that water,
right? So you're flushing a lot of it down the toilet.
You're flushing a lot of it
down the toilet. Is a lot of water collectively.
It's a lot. The toilet is still the largest single use of water indoors, closely followed by the clothes washer, by washing clothes. So the amount that's used for cooking is a much smaller fraction
minuscule,
of that.
Right.
It's very very small relative to these other uses. So the key to being a smart water manager is to take a look at your bill and begin to figure out how much water you're actually using. And then you can begin to kind of look around your home, your premises, indoors and outdoors, and look at the uses of water in a new light. There is a, if I can put in a plug, there is a website run by a nonprofit. It's called H2O House.
It's the number two, just H2O?
It's the number two. It's right. H2OUSE. It's a clever little...
Oh, my gosh.
www.h2ouse.org. Okay. It's a site that's maintained by the California Urban Water Conservation Council, which is a nonprofit that's made up of environmental NGOs that have an interest in water and public water suppliers. And together, they collaborate on water conservation and efficiency issues across the state. I would point out that H2O House was originally funded by the EPA in part, and it's not California specific. So people anywhere in the country, anywhere within the sound of your voice and mine, can go on the site and navigate around. You select rooms, you select devices within the rooms, you look at pop-up screens, you look at that provide you with water saving tips, some typical consumption patterns, opportunities to fix leaks, that sort of thing. Very, very useful. Much more than we could cover in the remainder of our hour. So that's why I want to take the opportunity.
And people really like to do that. If it's a good interactive site, it's like, tell me how I can be a part of it. And I think the numbers of people interested in that are truly on the rise. So that's great. And I will certainly do my social media piece with my team about getting the word out there about the site. I'm glad you mentioned that, because people like a call to action. So that's really great.
So I'd like to just pull a couple things from that and just say, okay, if you want to assume the role of becoming a better water manager and thinking about, your water use indoor now, let's have a couple initial, sort of easy tasks. One is, are there any leaks? Sometimes you don't see the leaks, and this is particularly true with regard to toilets. And what I'm talking about is leaks down the drain, not leaks on the floor.
Right,
if there are leaks
right.
on the floor, you'd know that right away.
Right.
But there are leaks down the drain that often start at very, very low levels, but may be going on for months and months at a time, and only gradually build up to substantial levels that may still be undetected until they're... You may be losing 100 gallons a day through a toilet before you could actually see a ripple in the bowl or hear a hissing sound.
100 gallons a day?
Yeah. You could be losing that much before a consumer really becomes aware of it. So the suggestion here is to take some simple food coloring, some safe food coloring, food dye.
Right.
That's like blue dye or
right.
whatever.
Right. I have those little really tablets that you can get easily where you just
sometimes
put it in
utilities
the tank,
will provide dye tablets
right.
for their customers. Even if the utilities don't, you can take food coloring from the grocery store and put a few drops in, put some in your tank,
right,
and come back in 15 or 30 minutes and see if there's any that's showing up in the bowl.
Because you really can't hear it in many cases. Like, I've got pretty good hearing. We did it for all of our toilets because we were at a Green Living Fair or something, and they gave out these little tablets, and we were fine. But typically, would it just be like a silent leak? So people should really get on it and put some dye in there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's surprising. Some utilities that have done surveys have found that 20% of toilets are leaking. So it is an issue.
Right.
Part of it is results from there's a sort of a rubberized kind of gasket at the bottom of the tank that goes up and down every time you flush it. It's called a flapper valve,
right,
understandably. And over time, those products are subject to losing their shape a little bit. They can get deformed from the action and from the water chemistry. Over a period of years, they can lose their shape, and if their shape isn't maintained to the original, then there can be a little bit of leakage coming in under the edge, and as they continue to deform, that leakage can become more serious. That's a fairly common type of a leak. If you go on H2O House, you can see about other kinds of leaks and other strategies for dealing with them. So that would be. Nobody's lifestyle is going to be, sustained by leakage. There's no sacrifice involved in eliminating, something that's complete waste. So that's a good place to go. Then let's go outdoors, because in many parts of the country, outdoor water use is half or more, and certainly in the arid Southwest, it's easily going to be over half of typical. Single-family residential use is going to be over half of it's going to be outdoors. So this is an area that really, really needs attention. Many people have automatic sprinkler systems built in, underground.
Right.
And many people operate those systems at night, which is generally it's recommended not to operate them in the middle of the day because the evaporation rates
factor,
are higher and the wind speeds can be higher and that sort of thing. So it's the conservation-minded approach is to operate them at night, but the question is, do you know how they're functioning? If they only go on at 4 or 5 in the morning, do you ever see your sprinklers running, and or do you go for 6 or 8 months before you actually see the system operating? So you really have a responsibility as a householder that's operating one of these systems to make sure that it's in good working order and that it's not being wasteful. So you have sprinkler heads that are subject to being damaged, being knocked out of alignment, how common is it for us to see water running across the sidewalk, water running into the gutter after somebody's operated their sprinkler system's been operating.
So can I just do a little, this is a question I have. It was really, this is so real. My husband and I were driving home during the day, one day last week, and there was a bad leak in one of the houses in the neighborhood, like really bad. It was already down several houses. It was running across the road, and we didn't know what to do. They were at work, during the work day. It was like, I can't imagine what their water bill is going to be like, because they're going to really take it in the shorts. But when you see something with what you're saying, we don't know where it, we didn't investigate it thoroughly, but we're like, oh, dear Lord, look at the waste of the water, and boy, are they going to be sorry. And we didn't know the neighbors, so it's not like I could have called them at work. It was a couple of streets down. In cases like that, you're talking more about prevention, looking at what your systems are proactively, not just having the timer go off, but really being actively involved in the water distribution system in your outside areas. Is that
right.
The reader's?
Who else is responsible
right.
for the operation of the irrigation system in your yard if it's not you?
Right.
Right. So you are, in fact, a water manager, whether you want to be or not. And you are responsible for it, whether you want to be or not. And of course, we want to be. We don't want somebody else to to take on that you know, the responsibility for our own property. So we've got to be responsible with our water use. Quite often, I see strips of land, often in turf grass, between a sidewalk and a curb. They may be 3 or 4 or even 6 feet. These strips are almost impossible to irrigate efficiently. The sprinkler heads keep getting knocked by pedestrian traffic or car doors or whatever, and it seems almost inevitable that irrigating those kinds of strips ends up putting water on the sidewalk, putting water in the gutter, or both. And you may have a patch of lawn or planting that's on one side of your driveway, and if you're still doing a hose and sprinkler system if you have an older home, and it just may be, you know, you may be irrigating that with your sprinkler and running it across the driveway. I mean, I see that a lot too. If you have an area that's so hard to irrigate that you can't irrigate it effectively without wasting water, then I think that should prompt the question, well, maybe I can do something else with
this. Yeah, maybe this is an area that I don't really need to water. So
maybe a different planting of some kind, so that or different ground cover. If you've got a hillside or a slope that you put water on it and it just can't retain it, then think about doing something different. Because if you're
really
running water on the sidewalk, if you're running water into the street, you're wasting water, and in most places, that's against the law.
Yeah, and it's not going anywhere. It's just being wasted. So let's take a quick break. When we come back, Ed, I'd really like to talk about what went on in California with the new water rate structure and how that looks for the rest of the country. Please stay here with me, Ed Osan, NRDC, talking about water. We'll be right back.
Go deep underwater without getting wet. Study bugs like a real scientist. Make your shadow move in colors. These are just 3 reasons to visit the exciting hands-on new exhibits at the Children's Museum Tucson, the region's only museum just for kids. For 25 years, we've ignited kids' imaginations at the Children's Museum Tucson. That's something to celebrate. And admission is only $2 on the first Sunday and on the 25th of each month this whole year. Children's Museum Tucson, where imagination and learning connect.
It's got advanced technology. It's got major breakthroughs in technology everywhere you look. It's the 2013 Honda Accord. Hi there, this is Mrs. Green, and I want to share with you that after nearly 40 years of heritage, this is the most stunning Accord ever. The highly respected Automotive Magazine raves that the 2013 Honda Accord offers unparalleled talent of goodness. Please visit Chapman Honda at 4646 East 22nd Street in Tucson to check it out and see for yourself.
Do you dare to share? In 2009, the University of Arizona started its car sharing program. Today, students, faculty, and staff have access to a shared fleet of cars that includes 7 hybrids and even the zero emissions Nissan Leaf. Not only does car sharing give the campus community wheels, but it takes all those extra cars off the road too. Now that greens things up, doesn't it? The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
You can save hundreds on home improvement by checking out Habitat for Humanity's Habastore. The Habastore sells new and gently used home improvement items for pennies on the dollar. You can find cabinets, doors, windows, light fixtures, furniture, and much more. Plus, our inventory is constantly changing. You'll be saving money, and all the profits go to Habitat for Humanity Tucson, helping to build a better community. The Habastore is located at 935 West Grant Road. You can reach us at 520-889-7200 or habitattucson.org.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And we're certainly being given a lot to think about from Ed Osan, who's a national senior policy analyst for the National Resources Defense Council, lovingly referred to and tweeted about as the NRDC. And we will be certainly tweeting a lot about this, Ed, to share your information, your knowledge, your expertise on such an important commodity, water, right? The only thing that we really can't live without. So I think a good segue at this point is there are going to be more initiatives. Like I said, water in Tucson is very inexpensive. And you sent me some information about the new rate structure in California that got approval about incentivizing people for efficiency. And my little background comment is the incentives for electric efficiency, like to save on your electricity, have been very successful nationally. I mean, if you can find ways to save on your electricity bill, because they're usually much higher, incentives work. So I liked when I saw this, and I think more states need to follow suit. So why don't you give us background on that? You were very much involved in it.
Sure. Let's start by going back to the consumer's bill, the consumer's water bill. Again, if you're going to be a smart water manager, getting a grip on how much water you're using and how you're paying for that is really pretty fundamental. So take a look at the bill, and the first thing to notice is what's covered by this bill. Is this bill just for water? What about wastewater service? Where you're paying for that somehow? Because again, most people, there are some people that are on septic, but that's probably about 20% of the country. So the great majority of households in the United States are served by a public wastewater collection and treatment system.
Right.
And that has costs and has to be paid for. So where does that show up? In a lot of places, in fact, in most parts of the country, people pay for water and sewer service together.
Right.
On the same bill, and what they pay for sewer service is based on their water consumption as recorded by the water meter, and there may or may not be an adjustment applied to that to account for the fact that, particularly in the Southwest, a lot of water is used outdoors. So what happens in big cities like Phoenix, Tucson, Los Angeles, San Diego, as a for instance, you get a combined water and sewer bill, and your bill for sewer service will be based upon typically what they do is that they look at your water consumption during winter months like December and January,
right,
when it's assumed that your outdoor use will be at its lowest. And so that is used as kind of a proxy for indoor water use, and then their billing rate per unit is applied to that level, and it may be carried that way throughout the year, and it'll true up the following year when they see how much water you're using in December and January of next year. That's the way most people around the country pay for water and sewer service. But in California, in Arizona, to some extent in Washington State and a few other states, we have quite a few freestanding sanitary sewer agencies that are not part of a municipal, they're not under municipal government, and they often simply provide they provide service with a flat rate per household, per connection,
right,
that doesn't vary by the amount of water that you use. And that is basically throwing away half of the price signal and half of the potential reward for consumers who are effective stewards of their water use. And in fact, it really doesn't discriminate between a household with one or two people and a household with five or six people. So we are doing some work to try to bring out the need to move sanitary sewer service to a volumetric pricing regime where it's not now in place. And even in areas that have some, you know, significant issues, in Arizona, Sierra Vista, for instance, folks there pay for sewer service on a flat rate.
Okay.
In the Phoenix metro area, Chandler and Tempe are paying on a flat rate, although Peoria and Phoenix and Scottsdale pay on a volumetric basis for sewer service.
Right.
So it's scattered around, and you have to look at your own bill. If you're not getting billed for sanitary sewer service on your water bill, then you probably ought to look at your property tax bill and see if there's a separate charge listed there for sanitary sewer service. But there's both an equity issue and a conservation issue here to take a look at. So that's one. Take a look at your bill and understand, you know, what you're paying for. And then the question is, are you being rewarded for saving? And Gina, you mentioned earlier that you felt that your water bill was pretty low. And my response to that is public water suppliers are basically recovering costs.
For their offices and things like that. They're really not charging us for the water. Is that pretty much true?
That is pretty much true. In most of the states, you're not paying for the water itself. You're paying for the facilities and services and labor that it takes to bring the water to your house. That's what you're paying for, or to take it away
right.
in case of sanitary sewer service. So they're recovering their costs, and they are what they are, and they have been going up. Now, this is something to keep an eye on, because over the last 15 years or so, and this is broadly true nationwide, water and wastewater rates have been going up at about twice the rate of inflation, about twice
wow.
the CPI.
Okay.
So they are starting from a much lower level than your electric or natural gas, but they have been rising more rapidly. So that is now, you know, for in a lot of parts of the country, the water and sewer bill, particularly if you look at them together, are more directly visible in household budgets. So the question is, are you being rewarded for saving? Do you have a billing structure, a rate structure that effectively rewards consumers that save and sends a sharper price signal to the high volume users that have more opportunities to conserve than they're employing? Even if you're fortunate enough to be served by a relatively low cost utility, the utility can adopt a rate design, a rate structure, a graduated rate structure, so that those who do save really are rewarded, and those that have very high demands on the system really pay more proportionally for the high demands that they're placing on the system.
Right.
And that's what we have been able to achieve recently in California at the Public Utilities Commission, with their approval for a new rate design for one of the larger of the investor-owned water companies in California, the California American Water Company. They're the state affiliate of a large conglomerate of investor-owned water companies called American Water Works. And in California, they serve about 600,000 people.
Wow.
And about 200,000 are covered by this particular rate case. And we negotiate an agreement with not only with the company, but with the state's consumer advocate office on a new rate design that is four tiers or four stair steps in the rate structure, and the consumption the breakpoints in those four stair steps are based on typical levels of indoor use and typical levels of outdoor use. And if you go beyond those, you're into the higher rate territory. So we were able to design this basic four-tier structure across four different divisions of this country that had very different cost profiles. And in some places, their cost of service is pretty low. In some other parts that are geographically separate, their cost of service was fairly high. We were actually able to make this four-tier rate structure work across both the low-cost and the high-cost districts in a way that the state's consumer advocate was quite comfortable with and ended up endorsing. So consumers in these disparate areas will have incentives to save. If they're in the top tier, they will certainly have an incentive to look for those leaks, to make sure that they're not there inadvertently. And for the households that are conserving, the core levels of indoor use for culinary and sanitary purposes, that level of consumption is being protected against, you know, really large increases. So, I think that's the pattern we're going to see going forward.
So here's what we're up against and why I had you back the last time. There's about 4 minutes left, and I have about 40 more questions. But what I'd like to end with, if it's okay with you, it's such an important topic. In the wording of the document that you gave me, there was something that segues to my last question. You said that the California American Water Company reached a water rate settlement with the NRDC. So I'd like to talk to you. I'd like you to talk to me a little bit about that. And then if you can, if we have time, the overall big picture in terms of your role and why NRDC exists to proactively address they're global issues. We're addressing them in the United States, but we never really talked about the NRDC. I'm so familiar with it, and we've had so many guests. Sure. It's like it would be great to end with that also.
Yeah. Well, NRDC, Natural Resources Defense Council, is a private organization. We're not part of the government. We're a nonprofit organization for education and environmental advocacy. And we were established not long after Earth Day in the early 70s, and now have about, in round numbers, we have about 400 staff in 5 offices in this country, plus an office in Beijing. We work on a range of environmental issues. We have a combination of attorneys and resource specialists that work together in teams and clusters on problems ranging from climate change to air quality to wildlife protection, public lands management, water, and oceans, to tick off some of our
big
main
ones.
Priorities. Yeah, big ones. Mm-hmm. In the case of the that you mentioned, we're talking about here with California American Water Company, we reached a settlement because we intervened in a rate case. The company applied to the Public Service, Public Utilities Commission, the state regulator in California, for permission to raise their rates.
Okay.
And so at that point, we intervened, particularly to focus on the rate design, not the amount of their rate increase. That was going to be driven by their costs and whether their costs were appropriate or whatever. Other people were arguing about their costs and how much the rates should go up. Our point was whatever revenue the company is allowed to collect from consumers, let's design a rate structure that collects that in a smart way, that rewards efficiency and sends a sharp price signal to those that are placing the greatest demands on the system during peak periods of summer demand. Because that really drives up costs for everybody, drives up costs for the whole system to meet that peak irrigation demand on the hottest summer day. The whole system has to be sized. All the tanks, all the pipes, all the pumps have to be sized to meet that peak demand that is driven invariably by irrigation requirements. So that's what we set out to do.
What a great partnership role
smart,
for you to play.
Design for that. Yeah.
So we have 1 minute left. I want people to know how to contact the NRDC. And the way I do it is just nrdc.com. It's not really hard to find.
.org.
Sorry. Yeah. I have it in my refresh button, so it goes there very easily. I really appreciate your taking the time. For those of you that just remembered to tune in, you can listen to the whole podcast. It will be up in about a day. This was Ed Osan, National Policy Analyst for the National Resource Defense Council. And I want to just do a little shout out for our show next week. We're bringing back Scott Roberts. He was one of the first guests on my show about 5 years ago. He's the film producer of the movie Gas Hole, and I always try to say that quickly so that people really hear me right. And he's the host of a TV show on FSTV called Gas Hole of the Month. And of course, he'll be talking to us about different types of fuel and fuel efficiencies and another big, huge challenge facing our country. Ed, thank you so much for being on the show. And I'm
I'm
going out on a limb here. I think we'll be hearing more from Ed Osand because I always have a lot of things that I want to ask you. So thanks for what you do and for your incredible knowledge. MrsGreensWorld.com. Follow me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, because we want to make a difference on a global scale. Thanks for being a part of our world. Make it a great green day.